Father, we pray with Psalm 19 that the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts might be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Now, if you've been on this planet for any more than a minute, you'll probably know the famous quote, knowledge is knowing tomatoes of fruit, wisdom is not putting it in a fruit salad. Yes, I'm sure you have heard it all, but it wasn't until a friend of mine went to Venice recently that the point became real to her. Christy, my friend, she mentioned to some friends that she was going, and they said, you must have gelato. You will love it. Moments into her trip, Christy found herself in a quaint little ice cream shop with 20 different varieties to choose from. Now, you can usually tell the flavour of the ice cream by the picture on the card, right? So, yellow ice cream might have a picture of a lemon on it. Pink, strawberry, you know how it goes. The idea of the pictures is to make it as easy as possible for tourists from across the world to choose the one they want. So as Christy kind of gazed across the flavours, a bright blue one with a Smurf caught her eye. She'd grown up watching the Smurfs. She loved them. It was the obvious choice as a treat. But when she placed the order, the waiter looked kind of puzzled. He asked her again, are you sure you really want that one? She was certain. And when she got it, as you might tell from the picture, it tasted of blueberries. It was amazing. And now, long after, Christy went to Rome again, and she made a point of finding the same ice cream. But once more, the waiter said, Adam, are you sure? Yes, your brother, I've been asked this question before. I'm not surprised, the guy said rather tentatively. You do know that's Viagra, right? Christy said she didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Knowledge was knowing the Italians put Viagra in their ice cream. Wisdom is not eating it. I love that story. I was texting her this week and she's never quite lived it down. I guess it makes us giggle. It makes an important point as well, though, doesn't it? There's a big difference between kind of assuming you know and actually knowing. In fact, I think it's a question, a point that kind of gets us to the heart of some of our passage today as we continue our journey to the cross through these final chapters of Luke's Gospel. In fact, we're going to go through some of the details in a moment, but as we see, Jesus is mocked and beaten in this sham religious trial. My hope is that we'll also see Jesus' true identity amid the callous rejection of his rule. That we wouldn't just have some knowledge, but we would really know it. Now if a little phrase helps you to get a foothold, here's the thing we're going to circle around. We see the calmness of the king despite the cruelty. Do grab your Bible if you put it down. We're going to pick up on that long, dark Friday morning as the master is mocked. Verse 63, again, the men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded him and demanded, prophesy, who hit you? And they said many other insulting things to him. Now, I'm sure it won't take long for me to persuade you that we live in a world where money often talks. Think of Epstein and the others who were able to get away with it for so long. Money often talks, but we live in a world where power is often expressed physically. Now, I think that's what we see here. Jesus has been dragged in, and even before he is booked into custody, even before he's booked into custody, he's given a kicking in the waiting room. It's the classic thuggish behaviour where might is seen as right. Those who have the power can get away with whatever they want. Here it's the guards, the prison wardens, the soldiers of that day. The historian Tom Holland, the historian, not the Spider-Man guy, he gave a fascinating point that these guys, that these soldiers are probably conscripts. They're much more likely to be Samaritan than Roman. And so the chance to drop an elbow on an ancient enemy would have come with an added dollop of spice. Maybe an added dollop of spite. The banter, the ridicule we hear of, which would have very likely included those very clear racial undertones, that very personal shot. And not only is Jesus beaten and flayed with whips, but it soon becomes a bit of a game, verse 64. They blindfolded him and demanded, "Prophesy, who hit you?" Yeah, throwing a hood over Jesus, giving him a smack, it's designed to make a mockery of his claims. You know, it's the laughter of the playground as the bigger kids pick on the smaller. It's the powerful in the office targeting the vulnerable. Come on then, Jesus, you're supposed to be a prophet. You're supposed to know your stuff. Go on then, smack. Who did that? You just imagine that, the howls of laughter. What a great game. Because just remember, Jesus is likely tied up or handcuffed. He can't defend himself. He can't even raise an arm in protection. And yet, isn't it astonishing? Do you see the calmness of the king amidst the cruelty of the crowd? Put yourself in his hood for a moment. Imagine those cuffs around you. Would you have held your tongue? Wouldn't you have bitten back at some of the racial jibes as they came in, or the kidney punch caught you off guard? Wouldn't you have screamed in anger at the sheer outrage and injustice of it all, just telling them, "You wait and see"? But don't just notice yourself. Put your eyes on Jesus again. One of the greatest proofs that Jesus was perfect without sin was his self-control right here. He was tempted to sin to the end. The words were designed to provoke him when they hurled their venom in his face for the soldiers and the priests later on with Herod and Pilate. They're each trying to catch Jesus out with words designed to cruelly mock. They knew what they were doing. They did not know what they were doing at exactly the same time. But I guess they kind of hoped he'd lose control. They thought he might crack now. In fact, for just one word, one unguarded comment, one rash shout in anger, and not only would they have had their excuse to keep going, but Jesus would have been stripped of his innocence. It would mean he could no longer be the perfect sacrifice we needed. But Jesus never, ever cracked. He never lost his temper or used his own power. Never once did he give in to temptation. Do you see the calmness of the king amidst the cruelty of the crowd? That the master is mocked at verses 63 to 65. But just keep reading. Because it turns out the jury have also made up their mind. Verse 66 says, "At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them." The inner doors of the courtyard there opened. This great crowd of priests bustle in, and there behind them you see him. Blindfolded, bruised, hands bound together, being shoved into this sham trial. Now, it might just be that these leaders have kind of read the latest in management theory. They're just trying to be efficient with their time. More likely, however, they're trying to rush their decision to get a verdict on the books before most of the city wake up and people start asking awkward questions. Of course, there's also the awkward fact that God had commanded them to rest on the Sabbath, so if they waited any longer, there was a risk that Jesus would have to be held until after the weekend and the opportunity would pass. So Jesus is dragged before this kangaroo court. Now they get straight to the headline in verse 67, don't they? If you are the Messiah, tell us. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not sure I've ever really understood why Jesus replies like he does. Have you ever wondered that too? I mean, why not just give a one word? Yes. It's an argument. I know a lot of Muslims use, for example, to say that Jesus never said he was God. But I think there's more going on than that. In fact, I think Jesus is actually being really, really clever and really, really wise. And what is going on then? Well, I think it's helpful to remember that the question they're asking, it's a political one. That they're trying to get Jesus in trouble with Rome. It's like the question, does your mother know you're stupid? It's a trap, right? Either you're stupid and your mum knows, or you're stupid and your mum doesn't know. But either way, you're stupid. I think it's the same here. Jesus can't say no, because he really is the Messiah. You know, the word Christ isn't his surname, it's his job title. He is God's rescuer. Jesus can't say no, but to say yes is a trap, right? If he says yes, that they've got all the evidence they need to get the death sentence out of Pilate, because Rome will allow no rivals. The jury have made up their mind. They've set Jesus up in a trap. So he kind of sidesteps the question and pushes it back. His captors are now in the spotlight. If you are the Messiah, tell us, they said. Oh, if I tell you, you won't believe me. And if I ask you, you won't answer. Now, we know from later on, verse 71, what Jesus says is true. They are just not interested. I found this quite a helpful way of putting it. Someone said, Jesus knows this isn't about trying to get a fair hearing. They just want to formalise what they've already decided. So he refuses to engage. He won't play their game. Does your mother know you're stupid? I'm just going to ignore the question. But the same happens when he's asked about John's baptism back in chapter 20, if you remember. Jesus just pushes the question back to them. He examines their motives. Now, I realise that quotes aren't everyone's thing, but let me give you another that might help draw things together. It comes from a theological hero of mine, the great reformer John Calvin, who said this. Even if Jesus were to prove 100 times that he was the Christ, it would make no difference to obstinate men. They'd not only heard, but also seen with their eyes the miracles which confirmed his heavenly identity and divine power. Those acts all cry aloud that Jesus really is the promised Redeemer. Jesus has spent a lifetime being crystal clear, but the jury have made up their minds. But there's a twist in the tale. Because it turns out it's the judge who's in the dock. It's our third heading if you're following along. But cast your mind, if you would, a bit further south to Avon and Somerset. A police officer there recently tried to find a loophole when she was allowed to work from home. She knew that, the office, they monitored her laptop when it was in use. So she put a picture on top of her keyboard to stop the computer going to sleep and to make sure the keystrokes were being logged. It gave the impression she was at work while she could go off for a cuppa. Ironically, keeping the picture frame there meant that the number of keystrokes recorded was 8 times higher than her colleagues. and professional standards started to become a bit suspicious. Like, she thought she'd found a quick win, but she ended up with far more than she'd bargained for. She was dismissed for gross misconduct. There's something of that back here. At the council are trying to incriminate Jesus, but they end up getting far more than they bargained. Just glimpse at verse 67 again. Jesus answered that partway through, "If I tell you, you'll not believe me. And if I ask you, you would not answer." At verse 69, "But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God." Jesus is standing before the council, arrested and condemned. Yet it's he who will sit at God's side, who will ultimately be the judge. Jesus tells these chumps that they don't ultimately have power over him. It's actually the other way around. He'll go directly into God's presence. He'll take the place of highest honour. He'll sit at the throne of ultimate power. They're outraged that he's claiming to be God. He says they have not understood it at all. Because he, Jesus, the very one they're trying to condemn, is the one they will have to stand before in heaven. In fact, fast forward a few days from this point. You get to see how God's plan's completed, yeah? They want to kill him for claiming to be God. Jesus says they can try, but ultimately they'll only prove his point in an even more incredible way. My friends, do you see how the resurrection changes everything? If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, he was a fake, he was a fraud, he was a liar. If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, he was not the Son of God he claimed to be. Jesus saved his ministry, his reputation, very literally his life, on the 100% cast iron fact that his resurrection was coming and his resurrection is real. If a visual helps you, picture it like this. In the resurrection, God the Father effectively pulled out the chair to welcome his Son home. I guess it's at this point the penny finally drops. At verse 17, they all asked, "Are you then the Son of God?" "You say that, huh?" Then they said, "What do we need? Why do we need any more testimony? We've heard it from his own lips." So you don't need a PhD to join the dots. It takes them less than a second to register what they have heard. There is no need for evidence. Jesus had every chance to say no, but he tells them they already know. The identity they put on him is true. I guess we wrestled before with whether Jesus has been cryptic or clear, but even if you're not persuaded by the genius of Jesus' response, these guys have got absolutely no doubt about his claims, have they? To their mind, they've got him. Jesus has condemned himself. He'll go to the cross by his very own words. Friends, we're coming into land. But just stick with this passage for a few moments longer and see how it connects with you. Yeah, because every time we open the Bible, we believe God's promise that he will be at work. I don't know if you've ever noticed it, but on the front of our church family news sheets, it's one of the expectations that we name here. Each Sunday, we expect to hear God speak with words that change us. What might that look like today? Well, first of all, I think the headline application for us all is to see Jesus' true identity. Despite the mocking and rejection of his rule, passages like this are meant to help us put down deeper roots, to grow in assurance that Jesus really is who he says he is, to hold fast to what is true even when the world says it is not. It struck me a little bit this week how our minds are always filled with different things competing for our attention. Wherever we go, whatever we do, we've got our AirPods in with music or our podcast on the go. There's a TV in the kitchen. There's a radio in the car. You'll find yourself endlessly scrolling the social feeds or looking through the web pages of new homes, new jobs, new Pilates classes, whatever your thing is. Maybe it's the rich and famous that hook you. Maybe it's getting the perfect body. Whatever it is, every day you're bombarded with relentless voices, vibrations in your pocket as an app's got a new alert for you, vying for your airtime, your headspace. And each trying to push Jesus just a little bit further to the sidelines. There's a reason, if you've got an iPhone, why the notification alerts are red, right? It's designed to grab your attention. Red means urgent. Red means, well, you can think about Jesus later, but this has got to have your attention right now. Passages like this, I think they invite us to step in and refocus. They invite us to see how clear Jesus is about his identity and how easily, like these guys, we can put our fingers in our ear and refuse the truth he offers us. So here's the question I'd love to lay before you. Who do you want to stand before? On the one hand, you've got the religious guys, the elders, the chief priests, the teachers of the law. Those people who are so quick to condemn. These people so quick to find fault, they will declare the innocent guilty and they'll hand him over to death. You can choose that path if you want. To stand before the judgment of the world, or you can throw your lot in with Jesus. The one the soldiers mock and insult so coldly, the one the religious leaders rage at with fury, but also the one who would show such calmness as a king despite the cruelty of a crowd, who would go to death for his enemies, who would take on the guilt of sinners like us and say that instead we are now innocent before our Father. Who do you want to stand before that? A world who will demand that you are guilty even though you're innocent, or a God who says he will declare you innocent even when you're guilty? Let me throw it to you for a second. How does this help you to live differently? Where might you need to say yes back to Jesus' invitation? As you think about that, I've got a song that we're just going to play in the background and listen to. It's a new one, but I wonder if it might just be really helpful.